This is Ross Valerie, and you are checking out The Jeremy White Show.
The stars live here.
Are you ready?
On air.
Are you
ready? Online.
Are you ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream. Broadcasting from Montreal and around the world.
The Jeremy White Show, available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Our next guest is an inductee of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, legendary bass player for Journey. Of course, got a brand new record out now, which is available wherever you get your music. All of the above, you got to go pick it up. It's fantastic. And of course, the new video for Lowrider, super, super awesome. Was watching it over the weekend. Highly recommend it. The bass is funky. Funky, I would say.
It's very simple.
Right? Welcome to the show for the first time, the one, the only, Ross Valerie. There he is.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. And thanks for the opportunity to reach out to that region of the world.
I'd say, well, I mean, the show's more international than anything. I mean, that's the funny thing about these shows, right? I mean, I'm on the radio in Canada and the U.S., but the show, like, it's international. Like, people in Australia are going to hear this and Europe, so it's...
160 countries, if I got that right?
Something like that.
Oh, hello, world.
Hey, speaking of that, you know, through your touring career, I mean, like, how many countries did you visit over those years? I mean, did you get a chance to visit all of them?
Actually, I didn't. Many people have the impression that Journey toured worldwide. It actually did not. The mainstay of the band's activities was in the Western Hemisphere, mostly U.S. and Canada, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Central America a little bit, South America a little bit, Japan quite a bit, but that's not the Western Hemisphere, so I'm already lying to everybody. We have done, at least as I was with the band, some work in Western Europe, but not to any great extent. So I've never seen Central or Eastern Europe. The band did go a few years ago briefly to Hong Kong and Macau, and did a brief tour of Southeast Asia, including Kuala Lumpur and Singapore. But I would say mostly U.S., Canada, and Japan.
Wow. See, I would have thought that Journey was such like, a global band like that. I mean, like, you'd have touched every inch of the earth, but it's interesting to hear that. I mean, was that a promotion thing? Is it because the band, like, didn't sell out there, or...?
I really don't know. It may have to do with the fact that the band in the initial big wave in the early 80s did not tour extensively overseas. Every other band and artist has been to Dubai, but not me. But then again, Journey continues to thrive, and they are going to Europe, as I understand. And who knows? They may make it further east than I did.
Well, that's it, right?
So, and of those places, Jeremy, that I have seen, very little time was taken to see them, except in Japan. There was a little more time there to adjust and have some time off. But with traveling to keep things efficient, you see a lot of asphalt, concrete, airports, hotels, and venues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, a lot of fans, you know, they would think that you visit all these cities, you get a chance to go and explore, but they don't know you're flying in the day of the show, just going straight to the venue, boom, back to the jet. Like, it's not the tour in a way. You're not like a tourist in these cities. You're there for business, reality.
That's right. And in this case, I actually got to make up for that. I just got off a plane last night with my wife, having spent some time in England as tourists.
Nice. So,
got to see more of London than I have before.
I love visiting London. You got to go to the Savoy, have a drink at the American Bar, and go out to the terrace, and you're on the Strand, and the whole thing. It's beautiful. Love visiting there.
Yeah, many sights to see.
So talk a little bit about this brand new record. I mean, like, All of the Above, it's out now wherever you get your music. Video comes out for Lowrider. You got some great guests on this, too. Talk a little bit about the history of this record and how this whole thing came about.
Well, most artists of my standing or my caliber, so to speak, that don't wait as long to put out a solo album. And as many do, and as many have, usually when they do, it is generally similar to the band that they're a part of. And as that's no surprise. And it sort of suits the fan base and the popular audience for the band of which they are in or of which they have been in. In my case, I've waited a considerable amount of time to finally getting around to release a solo album. But the philosophy behind it is that with all the wonderful work I had the opportunity to do with Journey, there was other music which kind of sat on the shelf and was incomplete. So about 12 years ago or so, I decided, you know, there's a lot of unfinished music and I should go ahead and finish it for its own sake. So very simply put, finish what you start. And this album doesn't represent at all the sum total of what I'm up to. It's a current log of those songs that I completed as compositions and arranged and recorded and produced. But it's moreover just not necessarily a diary, but this is all this music that has been also rolling around my head while I had the opportunity to perform with Journey for the majority of my life.
Right.
So it's an offering for and hopefully an opportunity for the world to hear the music. It's not necessarily an attempt to carve out a new place in the music business. It's philosophically more about just being able to share the music.
Now, were these song ideas that could have potentially been Journey songs, or were these always intended for you to be doing something else with it?
In retrospect, it's possible that Tom Lind could have become a Journey song. It lends itself certainly to vocals. In fact, that first release, Tom Lind, is probably the most similar to the kind of music I've been known for. And quite a few people said, oh, where's the vocalist? Well, maybe someday. But to answer your question, that's about as close as my repertoire to date would have suited Journey. Mm-hmm. But there's all these other styles. The songs are quite varied, in some cases extremely varied, and it represents my background in music in terms of what I have listened to over the years and the different instruments I played and the different ways in which I performed and sang right. music. Very eclectic. I come from a musical family in which whatever was on the radio or the turntable at the time was quite varied. I mean, at Christmas time, we would have Handel's Messiah, but it would also have Nat King Cole's Christmas album.
Wow.
So the kinds of music I was exposed to and appreciated was, you know, anything from, you know, Mendelssohn to Miles Davis, you know, from Bach to Fats Domino. Anything that was really good music was in rotation in the home.
Yeah.
And I have background in symphonic music as a bass clarinetist and also a background in a cappella choir performance as a bass baritone. So all of these things add to what you hear in this album. Lots of various different approaches to music and not necessarily oriented to be popular.
Right.
It's not necessarily popular music. It's just who I am or who I have been. And I'm so happy to have at least completed this first round and had the opportunity for people to hear it.
Yeah. And it's interesting you talk about all those different influences, because, I mean, where was that stuff when, like, how do you end up in a band like Journey? Because all of those influences are so polar opposites to what, I mean, the band was, right?
Not necessarily, but Journey has had, even with all the various people that have been in the band, the fine musicians and the fine writers, it's had a central axis oriented to performing popular music.
Right.
So it's not a polar opposite. It's just a concentrated effort as a bass guitarist, in my case, to be in a band like that.
But with all of those influences, I mean, like, were you necessarily able to express, like, all of that stuff that you absorbed, like, growing up as a musician? Like, was Journey the right outlet to get all that stuff out in a way?
In many cases, it was. In two particular ways. If I'm sure you're aware of early Journey, which was fusion. It was practically anything goes.
Kind of jammy.
This is the kind of music that we've created together, and these are the recordings and these are the performances. So the first two or three albums were a fusion. I mean, they did include certainly strong vocal work by Greg Raleigh. And certain songs had arrangements that lent themselves to popular music. But Journey was more experimental then. Mm-hmm. And so that would represent the kind of instrumental fusion music that I contributed more to in the beginning of the band. But there was another occasion, which was really a great outlet for all of us, let alone me. In about 1979, we had an opportunity as a band to do a soundtrack for a Japanese film. Mm. And as time has passed and as technology and the dissemination of music has increased, this album is available for people to hear. It's called Dream After Dream, and it's a soundtrack for a Japanese film. And we were given scenes and settings to create music for, and that was very, very creatively free for everyone involved.
Right.
And that been myself and Neil Sean, Greg Raleigh, Steve Smith, and Steve Perry. And we spent a month or two in Japan at the Sony Studios and had a ball. We had a great time just being creative beyond the obvious talent that we have had for popular music. So not a polar opposite, but just Journey is just one concentrated effort.
Yeah.
I should add that I was have always been into different kinds of music, and the dial will spin to all kinds of styles of music for me,
yeah.
So to speak. And I was in high school, and I was performing in symphonic orchestra in the a cappella choirs and listening to Dave Brubeck in the afternoon. And when I was a sophomore, a new guy showed up in town and approached me within a couple of weeks and said, "Hey, I know you play guitar at home and that you sing, and I'm starting a rock band with some of your friends. Why don't you get your mom to go down to the local music store, rent a bass and an amp? I'll show you the parts. It's easy. We'll have fun and make change." So
yeah.
That's how I was influenced as a 16-year-old to join a rock band, and things developed from there.
Right.
Well, Jeremy,
it's usually how it goes, right? It happens organically.
Right. Yeah. And I had a choice too. A very favorable choice, as I had been taking college prep courses in high school, along with being involved with the music program. But I was taking those courses that allowed me to enter college in science or medicine or technology.
I was going to say, were you going to be a doctor?
I could have been a doctor or a scientist. Let me take your pulse. Here, hit me.
Right.
That was an option for me. And of course, as things developed with the San Francisco music scene and the band I was in at the time that did fairly well, and then as that developed into being placed in the Steve Miller Band for a year and a half or two, and then that developed a journey, you know, from being asked to join a rock band to being, you know, at ground zero for the formation of Journey was just a marvelous occasion. So followed my intuition, and I had choices to either be going to school for a career of some kind or being a musician. So that's where the choice happened, somewhere around 1970.
And I guess you made the right choice, right? Because here we are.
So I really do.
Yeah. Talking about that, I mean, obviously I want to talk about this new record and stuff, but, you know, just go back to the Journey thing. It's like, at one point did you feel like the band was it a conscious decision to go from that experimental sort of jammy type of thing to being a little bit more commercial and try to be more mainstream? Was that pressure from the label? Was that Neil and Steve? Was it Jonathan coming in? Like, where did you see the band changing?
Jonathan was a result of a change in approach, and it definitely came from the record label. The first three albums sold gold. We had gold albums, and in those days, gold meant 500,000 units sold. So each of those albums sold 500,000 units. That's not too bad. This idea of gold changed. Sooner or later, gold became $500,000 worth of units, which is actually a much smaller increment, but the band was doing well with those albums, but the label wanted to do more. And so we made that conscious decision to develop more vocally oriented music. Hence the arrival of Robert Fleischman briefly, and then followed by Steve Perry, and then by Jonathan Cain, is a very qualified writer. So that's how it happened. The label wanted to do something different, and we were flexible enough to do it. And lo and behold.
Well, that's it. I mean, a lot of bands would sort of push back and say, no, we don't want to be there. No, we want to have our own identity. But you guys, no, we'll be the clay. Mold us. We'll do what you want us to do.
Yeah, well, we molded the clay, you know.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Anybody lost their identity in it, that's for sure. Just the switching from experimental fusion music to popular music was a good example of how flexible and talented everyone was with the band, and as some still are, being flexible, being versatile, and hey, no complaints here.
Well, that's it. I mean, all of a sudden you got somebody come into the band and you got a riff like a piano part on Don't Stop Believing. As soon as you hear that, did you think that was going to be what it is today?
Yes, but I think probably the most, the beginning of the wave for me was when I was driving around in the San Francisco Bay Area and listening to the FM radio. And this is about, 1978, Wheel in the Sky comes on the radio. That's when I realized, hey, this is moving along. Not that none of us felt that way intuitively. I think everyone had the idea. This is already successful. It's a matter of time and continuing to create and write and record and perform. Yeah, so there's this shift to popular music, and there's all of this approach to instrumental fusion music, which continued at least rolling around my head and in my spare time. But I pretty much put most of that aside for the career. And about 12 years ago, I figured, why wait? Mm-hmm. Why not just begin in my spare time, finish what I started? So I began leading the compositions and began working closely with a fine musician, Eric Levy, who is a current member and has been for quite a while with Night Ranger. But he has quite a varied background, as I would like to think I do. He comes from a band called Garage Mahal. Very much fusion, very much experimental.
That's a great and name.
We started together in about 2012 and began by completing the arrangement for the eventual recording of Wild Kingdom, which was the second release. So many of these songs actually go back years in having been written, but it's more recent in which they were completed and recorded in the last decade or so.
Talk a little bit about that. I mean, records these days, it's not much of bands recording live off the floor, a lot of overdubs, maybe doing it over Zoom, sending files back and forth. How different was this recording versus, you know, the stuff back in the day?
Well, it varies from song to song. Incident at Nishaborn, Saying You're Blue are, for the most part, live recorded, 4 to 5 people recording at the same time. So you get that live track, you get the live interaction between the players that's not necessarily arranged, and you have that sound and that feel. Those things happen more in real time, but there are songs like Wild Kingdom and Windmill in which we started with just bass, with Wild Kingdom started with two keyboards, my Calliope part, which is the core of the sound of Wild Kingdom, and Eric Levy on a Rhodes. We demoed an arrangement. That's the way it fell out. And then we developed the song from there and brought in the percussion and drums by Carl Perazzo and Alfredo Reyes.
Nice.
So that song was built. Actually, I did the bass last.
What are the odds of that?
I mean, it's a song that I've been noodling around with on the keyboards for years and hadn't even thought about the bass, and it fell out rather naturally. And the same thing happened with the Windmill, which was the third release. Again, a song that we built starting with my guitar part and a keyboard part. We laid out the arrangement that way and brought in the other players. But there's, then again, there's arrangements like an Incident in Ishabur and Senor Blue and Lowrider, in which we had four or five people playing interactively in the same room. So it's different from song to song as to how the song was recorded.
And I mean, the cover of Lowrider, I mean, it's super faithful to the original in a sense, but it, for some reason, I find it's got more of like a funk to it. I mean, like my original exposure to that song was like, it was the theme song to George Lopez. So I remember watching that TV show and like, that was the theme song. So I always thought that was the George Lopez song. I had no idea it was an actual song before that.
Well, see, but that's how it came to you by way of George Lopez. What I wanted to do with this song was to honor the original feel and the original sound, even the type of reverb and delay on the vocals, and the simple rhythm section parts, simple drums, simple bass, and capture that feel. So we tried to do as much as we could to honor the original arrangement and the original sound. Our arrangement is a little longer and a little more advised, especially at the end. Yeah, but
which is fun.
I'd like to think we honored it.
No, completely. And I mean it's probably a dumb question, but out of all the songs to cover, I mean, like, why Lowrider?
Well, it's somewhere in my press release as a statement, but we had just finished doing the basics for, I think it was for Incident in Ishabur, and I was sitting around, I'm going, you know, there's another cover tune that I've always liked that I thought, gee, that would be kind of cool to do, Lowrider. And everybody goes, let's do it. So it just so happens that that's something that happened really quickly. The right people were available at the right time. But it was a whim.
Yeah.
But a good whim.
Yeah. No,
I've got more whims for the next batch, but yeah, it's completely, and Lowrider is an outlier, so to speak. It's kind of outside of the box of the rest of the music, but you could almost look at almost all of the songs, except for three of them. They're all outliers. So the approach here is the music from song to song was so different to start with. What difference would it make if I did Lowrider? There's no genre. In fact, I'd go further to say that my genre is no genre.
Mm-hmm. That is a good way to put it, though. And I mean, look, I mean, you're a bass player. I mean, putting out a song with one of the most iconic bass lines of all time. I mean, like, it kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It just reflects all the influences that I've had over the years. In a secondary way, it also really reflects a little bit about the fact that I have played other instruments and that I've got a song in which I'm doing all the guitars, which is Windmill, and one song in which I'm playing keyboards. I'm not featuring myself as a multi-instrumentalist. I only play these other instruments on music that I write. I couldn't go out and jam with people on these instruments that way. But it reflects not only all the influences I have, but the album also reflects some of the other instruments that I've written with.
Yeah.
No, and there's more, by the way, Jeremy. Some people think, okay, this is it. This is his autobiography and that's it. No.
Just a one-off, you know, get it out there and say c'est la vie.
Continuing in the last 3 years, especially after the lockdown was finished, I'm continuing to this day to record more material. Mm-hmm. And if people think that my the scope of influences and styles are broad, It's actually getting broader. So I'm warning everybody, it's going to get even further out. And, and it's not my interest in engaging popular music, but some of it could become popular, but it's in, is my interest is being free to create, and hopefully people have a chance to hear it.
Yeah. It's not necessarily about the commercial success. It's more about, I mean, having fun and getting the music out there.
There you go. And I am blessed in that fashion to be able to do this.
Yeah. Ross Valerie, All of the Above, available now wherever you get your music. Fantastic record. You got 9 songs and their awesome music video for Lowrider, by the way. Really, really nice production. Really cool animation and stuff. I think it's like actually one of my favorite videos I've seen this year. It caught me by surprise. I wasn't expecting it. So
great. I assume that you've seen the other videos though, right?
No, I didn't actually.
Oh, you should. Well, there's 3 others, starting with Tomland, Wild Kingdom, and Windmill. Another one of my favorites is Wild Kingdom. It's something else. And I should add to this discussion a little bit about the artists involved with my work. Prairie Prince.
Yeah.
Performed drums on Tomland, but he's also done all of the artwork for the album cover as you see it, and other things maybe to come. And his longtime partner with the creative image of the Tubes is Michael Cotton. And I brought in Michael to do all of the music videos, and he's doing a fantastic job with it. And I think a Lowrider is a good example. If anybody hasn't seen the other 3, they should probably check them out.
Yeah, I'm looking at a Windmill right now, and like the swimming and just like the everything. It's fantastic. It looks great.
Right, and Wild Kingdom actually has sort of a storyline that's very unique, if not somewhat poignant. But Michael will continue and is continuing to work up music videos for all of the tracks on the album. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I like that. Well, go pick it up. All of the Above. Go watch the music videos on YouTube. Just type in Ross Valerie and they pretty much show up right away, which is good.
There you go.
You know.
For King.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of wanted to show up right away, right? And boom, it popped up instantly. So it's easy to find. It's like magic. Fantastic. Well, we still got some time, but just before we wrap up, I have a couple more questions I was just kind of curious about. Do you have any of your old gear from back in the day, like the old PVs and stuff, or have you held on to that stuff?
I do actually have. I've never been a big collector. You know, most people that have been around as long as I have would be collecting lots of guitars. In fact, some people have made good investments in buying lots of instruments they couldn't possibly play all of. But
right.
I do modest collection of basses, and I do have some from the old days. And I'm actually kind of eclectic is the word when I'm building sound systems for the bass. I use old and new gear. In fact, it reflects in the way we record in the studio here. Mm-hmm. We use inboard all of the modern technology in terms of plugins and modern gear, but there's also a gear that comes from the analog days that's also very useful. To answer your question, yes, I mix and match old and new. Sort of a Millennium Falcon approach.
Which is cool, though, because, I mean, like, that's what I loved about Journey. It's like, you guys were never afraid of technology. I mean, like, even Neil had him on the show, and we were talking about fractals versus, you know, his high watts. And
yeah, Neil is deep into experimenting and actually utilizing a vast array of equipment. He really is. And Jonathan is a consummate engineer in his own right.
Was there a lot of experimentation in the studio in the sense with gear, trying to find that sound? Because I said to Neil, I was like, just about his guitar tone, you listen on like Escape or those records, but like, nobody had sounds like that. I mean, like the records really sounded unique. The bass sounded like you guys, the guitars, the keyboards. It had a unique, original sound.
It would be difficult for me in depth to describe or to tell you how Neil got his sound, but in those days there was less technology and it was more about how a person played. I think from Neil's end, it's how he set up his guitars more than anything. from my end, some of the, I guess the better known tones for me is a use of a harmonizer for a song like Don't Stop Believin' or Send Her My Love. It's just one simple outboard device to get that sound.
So you weren't like really much of a gearhead in the sense, were you more of like just a plug it in?
No, actually, late in life, I've become a gearhead now.
Nice.
Full approach to performing, and in some cases, recording was one instrument, a tuner, and possibly a chorus pedal or a harmonizer. And everything would be performed by changing the position of my picking fingers on the neck and by selecting pickups and tonality to change from song to song or section to section.
Yeah.
More inclined to have a different instrument for different songs. And I'm currently using the Helix pedal.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, verb and delay and all kinds of effects, which I've never experimented with before. It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot to keep up with.
It
requires a lot. And there's so many musicians like Jonathan and Neil who have been delving and experimenting with the variety of technological advances over the years. So I'm just getting started.
Yeah. When the guys started to bring in tracks in the live performance, were you for that or against that?
Once again?
When the guys, you know, like, because I asked Neil about this, even like Dean, I was like, you know, when you guys started bringing tracks into the fold, because a lot of the stuff is like, there's a, you know, backing vocals that are on tape for the live show and stuff. Like, were you for that or against that when that technology started to come into the live performance?
Well, the way it happened is everyone was singing. Mm-hmm. It's not like a Milli Vanilli.
No, it's just there to complement it.
Yeah, in fact, in some cases, some of the songs required extra keyboard parts or a rhythm guitar that could not be played by Jonathan because he was playing his keyboard part. So, you know, I think it was it's a good middle ground.
Yeah. No, I completely agree, because it's like you see somebody, people online, like trashing bands, like, oh, they're playing the tracks, they're miming this and that. But I always say, with the price of concert tickets these days, people are expecting the perfect show. And if it doesn't sound good, they're going to be leaving there moaning, it didn't sound good. But then you have a small vocal minority that say, oh, well, they're playing the tracks, it's not live. But I'm all about the show. I mean, it's all about the show at the end of the day, right?
Been the case with Journey. Whatever was added was to bolster, not to replace, but to bolster. In fact, there's just so many bands that are actually doing what the critics describe, but not Journey.
Yeah. No, that's what I always like that. I mean, like, and, you know, I asked Neil straight up about that, and he was like, straight up, he's like, no, it's there to complement it, to make it sound a little bit more fuller, especially when you're in stadiums, you want a consistent sound.
Right, to bolster it. Well said.
No, that's it. One last question just before we wrap up. I mean, when Arnell came into the band, how did you feel about Arnell coming in, and did you think he was the right fit for the band?
Absolutely. And it was a Cinderella story for him coming, not necessarily from obscurity, but from a different world, a different part of the world, and a sort of a closed circuit that he had in Asia. He was and is the right guy for it. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was the best replacement. I mean, I think he still is.
Yeah, and at first there was some, you know, pushback from fans. How can you, you know, how can you do this? Well, we can, we did, and he proves to be the right fit to this very day.
Yeah. And look, I mean, he seems to be the only one that's never involved in any drama. I mean, all that stuff with Jonathan and Neil not too long ago, that was getting kind of crazy at one point. And I mean, the band's been, I like that. the word is mum, right? Well, I mean, look, even you had your fair share of drama with the guys. I mean, like,
I don't know about any of that.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, look, even you had your issues with Neil. I mean, like, well, how come you guys just couldn't work it out in the end at this point?
Well, just like with any family or any business or any partnership, there's always differences. But what's important to say is not about what went wrong, but what went right for everybody and continues to go right for this band as it thrives. We had some differences. We came to a good agreement and we just moved on with our lives. But what went right was for everybody to enjoy and to have enjoyed for decades. A very creative, vital, powerful band.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think
I'm blessed to have been a part of it.
Yeah. Do you think at some point you'll ever get back on stage with those guys, or is that just done?
I have no idea. Somebody asked me that in an interview a while ago, and I said, as I'll probably say again, knowing how unpredictable the universe is, I can't never say never. I don't have any plans to do so. I'm not sure if the boys do either, but we're kind of busy living our own lives right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you even want to go out on the road at this point? Go to the, you know, you just got off this beautiful vacation with your wife. Do you want to leave home and be grueling road schedule again? Is it a lifestyle thing?
That's hard to say. You know, touring extensively as I did with the band for decades, you can't knock it. It was made as comfortable as could be, but it's time away from other people. It's time away from family and friends, and sometimes friendships and relationships diminish if not they disappear. So there's a great amount of sacrifice that everyone who is involved with touring gives up.
Yeah,
nothing's for free.
No, well, that's it. I mean, you've got a whole life when you're not there, and it's like that life sort of gets neglected. A lot of artists say it constantly. Yeah. You know,
I'm sort of reintroducing myself to all of my nieces and nephews and great nieces and great nephews. It's like, hi.
Yeah.
Now, what are you?
Well, that's right. It's almost like
literally it's like, whoa, I'm just getting familiar with my greater family. And there's a lot of, and, you know, friends, too, developing new friendships. So,
yeah,
there's a definite advantage at this point in my life for not being on tour.
Yeah. And look, you put your time in. It's time to enjoy the rest of it at this point.
All of the above.
Yeah. Well, look, brand new record available now. All of the above. Ross Valerie. Go pick it up wherever you get your music. RossValerie.com. And, of course, the music video is available on YouTube. This is absolutely fantastic. We'll have to do this again and get a little bit more in-depth about the gear next time.
We shall.
Yeah.
I'll take you on tour. Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Would love
and
that.
And thanks, buddy, who's contributing to your audience.
The Jeremy White Show.
Get exclusive interviews and bonus content on demand now. Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show.